This is Andrew, and my topic this week, Wolf, is Apple the new Microsoft?
Of course not. They're spelled differently.
Well, they different number of syllables, different vowels.
They both have vowels. There you go.
Well, they both have vowels, but they have different vowels. So yes, off to a good start there. So I think it's worth asking, because I think there are a lot of sort of native Apple pundits, people that we've listened to it for a long time, people who've been around the scene for a long time, who still think of Apple as the underdog.
Yeah.
And tend to defend it from criticism as if that's the only important thing that they could do as people who talk about Apple. Mm-hmm. And I think that skews how we think. Because I think Apple is not the underdog anymore. And so I think it's worth thinking about. Now, if I say Apple is the new Microsoft to virtually anyone in our crowd, I'd get a lot of pushback because, you know, they're not exactly Microsoft. They're not exactly what Microsoft was at its heyday. So I think it's worth going through the details and seeing how they fit and how they don't fit. So I'll have a little pro section, a little con section as we go. So I think a bunch of pros here. And the first one is something that we've talked about before, which is lock-in. Now, when Apple was first making OS X, first releasing OS X, they tended to champion interoperable technologies. Mm-hmm. Various scripting languages, Unix, and then things that were proprietary but still cross-platform, like Java and Flash, that sort of thing. They said, you know, we're the best Java. Of course, they never were the best Java, but... And they were certainly never the best Flash implementation.
Really? They weren't ever the best Java? They had some innovations there, you know. Like, they had that...
I don't think they were never, like, the fastest.
They weren't the fastest, but they had some cool innovations, like the shared jars across processes, stuff like that. That was, you know...
Okay. Yeah. Well, they certainly put a lot of effort into it. I know that there was a fairly large Java team at Apple for a while. And then I'll give you a guess what years that gradually got whittled away down to be doing other things.
Yeah.
Now, even today, they still do some of that. So cross-platform languages like C++ are still an in-house favorite. But it's less so, I believe, than it used to be. And, of course, the big tell there is Swift, right? Because Apple has more or less said they want to replace these other languages with Swift. And Swift is not an open language.
Oh, it's open if you're inside of Apple.
What? So if you know who Rob Rex is, Rob_Rex on Twitter.
The legendary.
He has some very interesting things to say about programming languages and things. You should follow him. Friend of the show? He tweeted to me, I don't remember exactly how long ago, when we were going back and forth a little bit about Swift, and he said Rust 0.4 was much better than Swift 1.0, mostly due to openness. And what he meant here was that it was easier to use as a language to develop with, and so, you know, your 1.0 language should be better and easier and less buggy than a pre 1.0 language, and for him it was not. And this, you know, for Swift might wind up being a really great technical language for you know, better than these other languages for a lot of things. But it's also kind of better for them because they have control over it in a way that now they get to say which direction it's going to go in. And if you use it, you can't write, you know, Windows code with it, at least not yet. And other examples, you know, when they started out, the services that they talked about were things like the POP or IMAP email from iCloud and calendar support using things like CalDev, CalDav, I guess, CalDave?
CalDav.
CalDoff. and, you know, now they've got services like iMessage or like FaceTime or iCloud Drive or, you know, just the App Store. And all of those things are still things that they made because they were helpful for people, but they made them in part, well, I don't know if they made them for that reason, but they have the effect of saying, well, when you leave our platform, you can't use these anymore, as opposed to mail, as opposed to CalDAV. So I think that's one aspect of it. Lock in.
Well, it's interesting. But it's interesting because when you use iCloud for the calendars and the contacts, it is using CarDAV and CalDAV underneath the covers. So it's, you know, it has like that interoperability hurt, but they don't expose it really. I think if you figured out the URL, you probably could actually get to work. But I don't want to derail your point. Go ahead.
Right. And although those are kind of the older ones now, as opposed to the newer services like iMessage or FaceTime.
Sure.
I also think that one of the ways that they're like Microsoft of old was their killer instinct.
Yeah.
Microsoft backstabbed a bunch of its competitors back in the day, and I don't even remember
Stacker.
The details of it anymore. Excuse me?
Stacker,
right. That was one of them. Mm-hmm. Didn't they go around like WordPress? Didn't they basically? Some of that was that those companies stuck with DOS.
You mean a WordPerfect or something?
WordPerfect, maybe. See, this is why I don't know the details. Anyway, they did it to a couple of companies. They got kind of known for it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then Apple came around and the word Sherlock became a verb.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. This idea that, well, we'll wait for you guys to come up with something interesting and then we'll just do our own version of it. And shut you down through that. Another way that Apple has a killer instinct is with they have this crazy hard bargaining with suppliers. So there was that recent thing with the Sapphire Glass supplier.
Yeah.
And I looked it up. So they have a Wall Street Journal article that I'm going to put in the show notes. The company was called GT Advanced Technologies. I think they're basically bankrupt now. The reason that we know more about them is because they're going through this bankruptcy thing, possibly a lawsuit. And, you know, you find out that Apple was just trying to hold them to this crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy stuff. Now, you know, when people say, well, the kind of people who say, well, you know, defending Apple, they say, well, you know, these companies didn't have to work with Apple. But, you know, not every company is going to be like basically Steve Jobs crazy when they want to have stuff go on. So
is that like Tom Cruise crazy?
Yeah, I don't know, maybe. And then another way that I think that we show their killer instinct is with the App Store policies and things like that. Because, you know, Microsoft in its heyday, you know, they couldn't dream of basically being able to tell any of their developers, no, get off our platform, for reasons that we won't even tell you or that we can make up out of thin air. Mm-hmm. Like they would have loved that.
Oh yeah.
And you know, Apple is kind of out Microsofting Microsoft. When you think about it in that sense. So that's killer instinct. Another way they're the same, I think, is that they both have more money than God.
Yep.
And, you know, Microsoft still has a shit ton of money. And, you know, it's not really helping them as much as they would like, I don't think. But, you know, they have some chance to turn their ship around and start finding markets that they're going to succeed in again the way they used to, because they've got enough money to do that. But once you kind of decline, it gets hard to change, even if you've got money. But Apple's got a lot of that money now too, and you can see some of that with Apple as well, that they've got this giant hoard of cash and nobody knows what they should do with it. I'm not sure they know what
they should build. A car.
All right, maybe somebody knows what they should do with it. I also think that they're in the same way that with Microsoft, they have super scale. You know, Microsoft's idea was a PC on every desktop. I think that was what they said.
Yeah.
And they got pretty close to it. Mm-hmm. You know, all the people who were going to buy a computer, most of them bought, vast majority of them bought Microsoft computers. So, you know, they were everywhere. They were in all sorts of markets. And I think Apple now is at the scale where, you know, for us as developers, for us as the people who remember Apple being the underdog, you know, there's now not a single piece of Apple's business where we or basically anyone might be able to apply pressure to them anymore, because none of those pieces are important enough. No one app matters to them enough that they couldn't, you know, you can go, Microsoft can go from iOS anyway, from the platform that kind of matters. There's no specialty market that matters to them, you know, professional audio, video, photography. They haven't really killed their apps, but they've kind of pivoted their apps, if you can excuse me using the word pivot. by trying to make them more general purpose, more useful to regular users. And of course, then the specialists all complained about that. But, you know, they don't care. We're the phone company. We don't care. I should find that video.
Yeah, definitely find a link to that.
Yeah, because, Final Cut, Aperture, you know, they killed Aperture. They're killing Aperture.
Tomlin, right?
Education, yeah. I don't think, matters enough for them to make big changes to their overall professional direction.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, it's problematic for us as developers, but I think it's also just, it's almost hard to fathom, really. And let's see, the last big one that I wanted to mention was the strategy text. And to talk about this, I'm going to quote at length from an article, I believe it was by John Siracusa, and it was in 2011.
Yeah, I think he coined that.
I don't know if he coined the name, but he popularized it.
Oh, you know, I think, wasn't that the Ed Catmull, maybe is based on him, but I don't know. But go ahead.
Yeah. So he says in this article, the tension between being a platform owner and also trying to build new businesses on that very same platform is another thing that Apple shares with Microsoft. But Microsoft is also a perfect example of how this strategy can seemingly succeed in the way that Microsoft won the war for the desktop and Microsoft applications came to dominate the Windows platform while blinding them to the long-term failure scenario that they were facing. And he says, in this case, it being a lack of competition allowed Microsoft's products to stagnate and the next round of innovations happened somewhere else. Now, I think Apple is fighting that as much as they can, but the strategy tech still exists. So if you look at, you know, they, you know, on their platform, you get 30% cut of all sales goes to Apple. But iBooks doesn't have to pay that tax to Apple. So basically, they were able to undercut all of the other ebook vendors on their own platform, basically kill them off because they were dealing with publishers who said, well, you have to pay us this amount of money. And so they couldn't make it work. And they complained about it, and, you know, I don't think anything happened. The Apple Maps, I think, is a great example of this, where because of their strategic directions, they basically substituted a worse piece of functionality for a better piece of functionality for the sake of their own strategy.
Yeah.
Now, you could argue that, well, they're going to make it better in the future. I don't think they ever really are. I mean, Google Maps is almost always going to be better than Apple Maps.
I think so, yeah.
They've been doing it longer. They've got more of an incentive to make it work.
And they have more resources on the ground, literally.
And more, they're just better at it.
Yeah.
And so if Apple said, well, we want the best platform, they would have gone with the people who were going to help make them better. I also think the way they encourage the race to the bottom store pricing on their platform, and the way, I mean, they might not have done it entirely on purpose, but they certainly didn't try to stop it. And, you know, it helps them because it sells phones if all the apps that you would ever want on your expensive phone are free.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't help developers, but, you know, hey, they don't care about developers. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, that's probably going too far, but they don't, it's not important to them that they shore up developers like that. And I also think this is something that they've been doing forever, but I think it's interesting that they've never changed it, is, you know, the fact that they always keep their future plans under wraps because for them, it's more important to promote their platform in a way that, you know, gets all this media hype and everything. But, you know, that means they don't tell their partners, they don't tell their developers, hey, here's what's coming up. So, you know, we've got a guess about the watch in a lot of ways that we wouldn't have to otherwise. And that's, they've always been doing that, but I think it becomes more of a big deal as they become the only, you know, the most important platform that's out there. Okay, so that's, we'll stop there for the pros. For the cons, it's interesting. I think this stuff is really probably the heart of it, because when people say, well, Apple isn't the new Microsoft, they mean things like the fact that Apple isn't going for that 100%. They do have a lot of scale. They're selling, you know, millions of phones, but they don't want 90% the way Microsoft did, or 100%.
Good point.
They want the cream of the crop.
The BMW.
They want the people who are going to, the BMW, they want, well, not more than that, because they want everyone who's going to pay them a lot of money for a phone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of people. That's more than, you know, BMW is one luxury brand among many. Apple is kind of, you know, in some ways the only real luxury brand for a lot of these things. And so, you know, people say, well, then that means they're not Microsoft. But I think the other side of that is, though, that while they don't have a monopoly, they're still the one you have to develop for. You can't ignore them.
Sure.
And you used to be able to ignore them.
Yeah.
Another way that they're different is that they don't care what people think, I think, the way Microsoft did. Microsoft was in some ways very kind of eager to please certain things in certain markets, the business community, that sort of thing. And then, you know, they recently changed their kind of Metro interface to allow people to go back to the old Microsoft, the old Windows interface. I think that was one. It's one way that they've said, nope, we're not going to stick to our principles on this thing. Mm-hmm. If it's kind of hurting us, hurting our bottom line. Apple has a very specific philosophy, and they're just not going to change from that philosophy. But I think that kind of blinds people, because then they kind of think, well, they're still this boutique artiste little firm, right? Because they've got this vision. Mm-hmm. And what people, I don't think they recognize is that while Apple has a very specific philosophy, they're also still going for the money. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to come out with something that's beautiful just because it's beautiful. They're still only going to come out for that if it's going to make them a lot of money and give them, you know, kind of a market that they can, I don't know, corner might be the wrong word, but dominate.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I think that's very Microsoftian. So I think, well, this is going to be a bit of a dangerous territory. I actually think one of the best comparisons for this would be to the American political system. Because I think with, you know, Democrats and Republicans, two big sides for that, there's furious competition between these parties. And they're like, there's furious competition between Microsoft and Apple, Google and Apple. So people tend to think that they're totally opposed, that they're different in every way. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot that the parties also agree on. And again, I'm going to get myself in trouble, but I'm going to say things like the war on terror. I think the vast majority of the major politicians from both parties will agree that, you know, we need to do this. Mm-hmm. And so they argue with each other about who supports it more or who supports it in the right way. But they do that because they both support it.
Right.
And I would say that in a lot of ways, it's the same for Apple and Microsoft. If you think the most important thing about these computer companies is kind of their cultural markers, is what their stuff looks like, what they espouse as their philosophies, then you probably believe that they're entirely different. They're completely on opposite ends of the spectrum. But if you look at underlying infrastructure, sort of the economic bedrock of how these companies have been operating, and the way they affect the ecosystem, the way the whole ecosystem kind of revolves around them at this point, I think you realize that they do have a lot in common, some of which I've already talked about. And so I would think anyway that we're all Microsoft developers now.
You just did all that just so you could lead up to that one last sentence, right?
Kind of.
You have a history of this.
Anyway, so that's it for me.
Okay. Well, I thought you did a very good good job of putting the pinky toe in the political waters there. And pulling it out without the shark.
Pull it right out, yes.
Without the shark, take off the foot. Okay. So my topic has nothing to do with any of that. It's real-time systems. So this is, of course, another non-topical topic, which is one of my favorites. And it's been something I've wanted to talk about for a while, but this has been pretty low priority because it has really doesn't have too much to do with modern desktop development and iPhone development, but it's still interesting kind of the trade-offs involved. So when you talk about like real-time systems, you tend to think like the kind of the classic Tannenbaum kind of scenario that's trotted out is the nuclear power plant, where if the rods get too hot, you got some temperature sensors on them, and you got to put that coolant in a certain amount of time before it goes supercritical. And the problem is that, you know, that this is, you know, we don't, you and I don't tend to have, like, you know, our hands on nuclear power plants. And so it's kind of an abstract thing. So the.
Speak for yourself.
Oh, are you a nuclear Boy Scout? That's a little reference for you kids playing at home. The example I like to use, the scenario I like to use is airbags in cars, because we tend to, if a lot of us own cars, or at least ride around in cars. So, and we have these pretty amazing things where it used to be, you know, you'd be lucky if you had one, like, airbag in the driver's side. But now there's multiple airbags that get deployed depending on the severity of the crash. And so when you think about it, this is a real-time system, and it's a hard real-time system. So as the car is impacting another object, or I guess that's another object, as it's deforming, various sensors fire. And so there's a very limited amount of time that between when the sensors are firing, when the decision has to be made, whether to fire airbags at all and which ones to fire. So you might be reading gyroscopes and motion detectors and stuff like that. I'm not a car guy in terms of that type of stuff, so I can't give you exact details. But I think you can see how you have, you know, as your car is crumpling against an object, you obviously have this. If you have a real-time constraint there where you have to make decisions and you don't get to pause.
So yeah, you can't use an NS notification for that.
Yeah, good point, yes. So you can basically classify these real-time systems into hard real-time systems and soft real-time systems. So we'll go with the hard real-time system first, which would be the nuclear power plants and the airbags firing and stuff like that. So this hard real-time system used to be more difficult in the early days of less powerful processors. They only could do so many calculations per second, and I guess that's true even today, but the number of calculations you could perform were much, much, much lower. And so you had to really work within the limits of what these processors could do in the first place. And nowadays, we obviously have much more powerful processors, but it turns out that real-time processors basically have to be specialized. And that's because things like processor caching end up screwing up hard real-time systems. And so what you usually have to do in these hard real-time systems is that you actually have to count cycles. You have a given program, and you know how long each cycle takes for a processor to dispatch an instruction, and you count them up, and you make sure that you're well below the necessary range of what goal you're trying to achieve. And things like even like malloc, are usually too high level to be put into hard real-time systems. And as I mentioned in episode all the way back to episode 9, Alien Reference Counting, that we tend to look at malloc and say, oh, you know, that's really cheap. And it is, you know, on the scale of things, really cheap. But it is not predictable how long that thing takes. And you can have pauses, even in something as simple as malloc. So when I first started learning about real-time systems, when I thought real-time, hard real-time, I thought fast. And it turns out that it's not so much fast or speed that's the key there. It's predictability. That optimizations that speed up the common case at the expense of predictability can't be used. So I talked a little bit about the processor caching and stuff like that. If you have a range of what the worst case scenario is, where every instruction, everything it touches is a cache miss, and if you can do that math and it all falls below your goal, then you can use a processor with caching. But I don't know the spec sheets on, I don't know if Intel will even give you that data on a modern x86 or an ARM processor. Just because these, you tend to use more specialized processors for hard real-time systems. And so this is, I heard way back when that, before there was IOKit as we know it today on OS 10, 10.0, there was IOKit written in Objective-C. And a modern IOKit is written in embedded C++. But in the old school stuff on NextStep and OpenStep was written in Objective-C. And I heard that there was that IOKit used to have its own version of OBC message send. That would actually not use certain classes of optimization because on the worst case scenario, you'd end up not being able to, you'd end up dropping audio packets or something like that, where it was unpredictable enough that it wasn't suitable for audio processing. And it turns out that audio processing is actually, human ears are very sensitive to any skew, any low latency on audio processing. So it tends to be among the gold standard of human perception of real-time systems. Unfortunately, that turned out to, from what I can tell, is a myth. I don't even remember where I heard it from, but I did ask Greg Parker, and he told me that he couldn't find anything about it. So I trust Greg. So this leads us. So that's hard real-time system. It's really a different beast. It's really in its own world. And what we're much more accustomed to dealing with in our workaday life is soft real-time systems. So on OS X, you have the spinning pizza of death. That's where your program isn't responding for long enough, isn't fetching the event loop, and the operating system decides, oh, you're probably should be marked as being non-responsive. On iOS, we have the watchdog, which if you don't respond, I forget what the amount of time is, but a minute, 2 minutes, something like that, minute and a half, that iOS will just say, okay, you're not responsive for too long, and because it's very much more single-tasking than OS X, I'm just going to kill you outright. And that's pretty much, from what I can tell, is a good decision. And so it's really just gross negligence that we run into watchdog type of scenarios of the watchdog biting us. Usually it's a flaw in our program that we haven't figured out yet. But a real thing that has to do with soft real-time systems that we have to deal with a lot is iOS main thread latency. And to a lesser extent on OS X, OS X boxes tend to be so much more beefier that we run into this less often. But it is an issue there as well. And the with iOS, on episode 109, Race the Beam, you talked about Async Display Kit. And I think that maybe it's linked from there, but it turns out that once you actually do the math and when you're trying to hit 60 frames per second of smooth animation, you actually have very little time to do anything. And with if you end up putting that on the main thread is busy with other things, like with potentially dealing with animation, with dealing with user input, with maybe network I/O. So the idea is that you want to get everything off the main thread as you can, and that's what Async Display Kit gets you. And so that's more of a soft real-time thing. No one's going to die if you don't hit that, but it's more of a user experience type thing, much like the audio thing, where I would say it's funny because I've seen people use Android phones, and they've gotten a lot better in recent years, but they were quite jerky initially. And you'd be surprised on how many people didn't notice, but they would notice if their music skipped. So you can see kind of the priorities there about human perception and real-time systems. So that's pretty much what I had to say about real-time systems.
Well, and you said it in real time as well, so that was a...
I always listen to podcasts at 2x, so I don't.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, have you worked on systems like that?
Sadly, no. The closest I got is the soft real-time stuff, and I've done audio work. But even that's soft real time because you can malloc. I mean, look at Core Audio, right? That's a C++ API for a reason, because they don't want to suffer the variable overhead of obviously message send, at least. But it's funny because most people who end up writing audio apps for iOS or the Mac end up putting an Objective-C library on top of it to thus make it much easier to use. So this goes to show.
Right? Yeah. 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 Let's see. I never did anything embedded. Well, the people who came before us worked on other smartphones, worked in more, I think, embedded-like systems because they were just so much less powerful. But I don't know if that meant that they actually tried to make them real-time capable, or if they were just put up with the fact that they were just always really slow to do everything. Because there have been devices where you wanted them to be more real-time. Why haven't there been But I guess that's just specialty stuff, medical devices, I guess.
I remember programming the Palm devices. Devices were really, really interesting because they were, 68,000 processor, and they used A-traps, and it felt very Mac-like, even the design language. And it was probably the thing that you'd notice most there is kind of like the digitizer and was following you. And that worked out pretty well. And although I have to believe that they had probably used some specialized hardware to make sure that worked well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All righty. So we will see you next time.